Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 24th of March. Human evolution has been gathering speed for the past 50,000 years, and today natural selection may be changing the human genome faster than ever. And of course, the question is, how is natural selection changing the human genome, and why faster than ever? Our guest is Professor John Hawks, Assistant Professor of Anthropology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His research areas include paleoanthropology, anthropological genomics, population genetics, statistical approaches to fragmentary samples, and old world. He is trained as a paleoanthropologist to use evidence from the fossil record. You have to be trained in human anatomy, he says, especially bone anatomy, and you have to know the anatomical comparisons between humans and other primates, and then the way that these relate to habitual behaviors, ancient environments, and also they're not the same as the ones that we experience today. We have a lot to talk about this hour, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for our guest as well. The number here is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Professor Hawks, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, thank you.
Yeah, so what's happened the last 50,000 years, sir?
Well, I mean, essentially, everything that we see around us culturally, you know, the kinds of cities we live in, things we do, the way that we make our living, it's completely transformed in the last 50,000 years.
Hmm. And I guess common myth would be that it hasn't, that all the changes took place a long time ago and nothing's changed, at least in the last, 5,000 years.
Yeah, a lot of people look at the way that we live today and think, wow, things are going pretty well. You know, we live a long time. We don't seem to have any trouble having kids. You know, so this is easy living in evolutionary terms. You know, it looks like things are going pretty well for humans. But over the course of the past 10,000 years, as we've really transformed our lifestyles, that has, at every stage, resulted in extra people dying who might have survived and people not having kids who might have. And that's the real engine of evolutionary change.
Mm-hmm. And how dramatically have we changed our lifestyles? Is it that we're inside and we're using computers and we're sedentary, or what is it?
Well, the biggest changes have to do with the way that we get our food and the groups that we live in. 50,000 years ago, the entire world's population was probably on the order of a few hundred thousand.
That's all? Just a few hundred thousand?
Yeah, pretty much, the population of a city like Madison, about the size of the world's population.
Oh, my gosh, I never thought of that.
And people lived in very small groups. They tended to be very mobile. They moved around a lot. They ate a lot of lean, wild meat, and they gathered vegetable foods, but it wasn't grains like we eat a lot of now. They, ate a very small proportion of that. So as they developed agriculture, which means that they became sedentary, they stayed in one place, they planted crops, they waited for those to mature, they had to be in one place to do that. They started living in larger groups, they started eating different kinds of foods, they really cut down on the lean meat, and over time, as they domesticated animals, they added fatty meat and milk products, and they ate a lot of grains. That transformation affects almost every element of the human body. The digestive system, because you're eating different foods. Mm-hmm. The nervous system, because you're living in different kinds of groups. You're interacting with different numbers of people. You're specializing on different professions and different kinds of farming techniques. And disease, finally, because when people start living in one place, the opportunity for pathogens, bacteria, viruses, parasites of all kinds, just magnifies.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the ability to take in milk that we – tell me, is it a genetic change that we needed because we didn't used to be able to digest that?
Yeah, people have heard of lactose intolerance.
Yes.
And if this is not an allergy, some people are born with a milk allergy. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, the ordinary – lots of people in the world – have trouble digesting milk, especially when they get to be adults. If they drink very much of it, it gives them digestive discomfort. We call that lactose intolerance. Now, it's not tremendously common in Wisconsin, you know, the dairy state, except that there are large sets of the world's population, immigrants from Asia, immigrants from sub-Saharan Africa, immigrants from, to some extent, southern Europe, who don't have a high frequency of milk digestion as adults. Now, this digestion of milk is very strange. Most mammals, you imagine the situation where an adult mammal can get milk. It's got to be very rare, right? Like the bull nosing up under the cow. It doesn't happen. So it's normal for mammals to shut off the enzyme that digests the sugar in milk. That's lactose. Lactase is the name of the enzyme. Northern Europeans, in particular, have a mutation to this enzyme that produces it throughout their lives. There are three groups of sub-Saharan Africans who also have this, and every one of those three groups is a group where keeping cattle has been a long-established cultural tradition. So in these populations, we have milk digestion today at higher efficiency. Other populations have a high proportion of lactose intolerance.
Let's go back to the population for a moment. How many people live on Earth now?
Today, 6.5 billion.
6.5 billion. 50,000 years ago, it was a few hundred thousand. What happened?
Well, essentially, technology started to change. People improved the way that they were making a living, and the climate helped them a little bit. So we had a dispersal of people out of Africa sometime before 50,000 years ago. That population grew, and that growth was based on technology, we think. They had better ways of getting food, better ways of hunting animals in particular. After about 30,000 years of this, the population had grown to several millions, and they'd spread throughout the world. They spread into the Americas, they spread to Australia, they spread into the northern parts of Asia. They were pushing at the limits. And at that point, the climate change at the end of the Pleistocene actually helped them to become agriculturalists. They started to observe, hey, look, if we plant this kind of stuff, it'll grow and we can collect it again. That change in lifestyle caused massive population growth. We went from a few millions to hundreds of millions very rapidly. By the time of the Roman Empire, 2,000 years ago, the Earth was populated by a few hundred million people. And, of course, since that time, it's continued to grow.
Right. You have talked about the fact that if people from 50,000 years ago were transported to today in a time machine, they would probably be dead within 2 years. How so?
Well, the massive change in lifestyle, and living in cities, living in big villages, clearing land for agriculture, every one of those changes has enabled human diseases and pathogens to become more powerful. So, for instance, today, the biggest disease killer in the world is malaria. Malaria is only 5,000 years old, the type that affects humans the most severely, falciparum malaria. That started when people started to clear land for agriculture in West Africa. They started to create mosquito habitat. Every time you start keeping, you know, clearing off trees and keeping things in pottery where water collects, you have mosquito habitat created. That major change in our environment allowed malaria to become a severe disease killer. The major changes in sanitation that come in with cities. People start drinking their own excrement. They are spreading diseases by that pathway. They're crowded into small places, and diseases can spread more quickly by air. They have rats that start infesting them, and the bubonic plague starts spreading. Every one of those shifts is creating disease that we didn't have before. Now, humans have become adapted to these diseases. We're used to them now. And the reason why we're used to them is because 10,000, 5,000, 3,000 years ago, people died of them. And they took away genes that were less resistant. And what's left is the fortuitous, the good genes that happen to protect people. It means that when populations come into contact that have been isolated for a long time, like Europeans coming into contact with the New World populations, or a lesser-known case, when people landed on the Andaman Islands. This place is in the Indian Ocean, and it's inhabited by very small-bodied people. Those people are highly susceptible to mainland diseases. Anytime one of these big diseases, like smallpox in the New World, enters a new population, you see the deaths in high frequencies that already happened to people who've lived in Europe, Africa, and China for hundreds of or thousands of years.
Mm-hmm. I don't know very much about the Andaman Islands. Is there a movement to keep everybody from coming to visit?
There actually is. Yeah,
is there?
They're isolated now by order of the Indian government because people get out there and they carry diseases with them. And any time a disease comes in, it's likely to kill.
I know that during the last couple of years, you've been spending a lot of time working with the Human Genome Project and the International HapMap. What are you doing with that?
Well, essentially, the Human Genome Project was, you know, the goal of it was to sequence every base pair. When we say DNA is made up of base pairs, those are chemical letters. And the chemical letters make a code. And so to read the entire genome of a person, which amounts to 3 billion base pairs, that genome encompasses the genetic code that leads to the creation of a body and its normal functions. But reading the letters isn't enough. The thing is that we read the letters, but the fact is that we only know what a very small proportion of those letters mean.
Mm-hmm.
And so the next step in that was to find out which parts of this DNA are different between people. One way that we can study DNA is by studying differences, because we know that people are different. And if we can find out the things that make people different by finding out which parts of their DNA are different, then that tells us what the DNA does. And the HapMap is the project that attempts to uncover these variations between people. Now, my work on the HapMap has been to try to find variations that have been changing in the recent past. So when we say recent in anthropology, we tend to mean the last few thousand years.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like ancient history, for most things. But for us, it's recent because it takes a long time for things to change. So we're finding the parts that are changing the most rapidly. And those parts are the parts that have been important in creating humans as we know them today.
It's fascinating work. It certainly is, when you think about cutting-edge science, that's it, isn't it?
That's absolutely right. You know, we're discovering things every day that we didn't know a year ago. And to be able to correlate the genetic changes with the kinds of changes in function, like, you know, the genes that contribute to type 2 diabetes, the genes that contribute to resistance to malaria, the genes that might have caused people's bodies and skeletons to change over the course of the past few thousand years. Those are really exciting times for an anthropologist.
Yeah, I'm sure. And you study, tell me how you go about doing this. You have to study fossils, right? You have to look at the fossil record and be trained in human anatomy in order to do the work that you do.
Yeah, I come at it from two directions. And this is sort of rare because when we look at genes, we're looking mostly at the genes of people who are alive now. You know, they took cheek swabs of people, and they're studying their genes. And those genes contain a record of what's happened to those people's ancestors in the past. So by studying the genes of living people, we're actually studying their ancestors. But the other direction of this is studying the bones of the ancestors themselves. This is something that is old-time science in the sense that, you know, in the 19th century, you're able to go out and dig up ancient cemeteries and study things about their bones. You know, what diseases did they suffer from? How big were they? Were they different in shape? Did they have different lifestyles than us? We can interpret a lot of things from their bones. I'm standing in the middle and trying to put together these two sources of evidence. You know, can we show that there were genetic changes that correspond to the ancient skeletal changes that we find? When we see evidence for intensification, you know, bigger populations, new means of subsistence, you know, making your life, can we show that there were genetic changes that were happening at that time? That part of anthropology is really growing now because of the huge data that's coming from the Human Genome Project.
We welcome phone calls, and we'll take them in just one moment. There's obviously a lot to talk about here. Professor John Hawks is our guest, assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we are looking at human evolution, how it has been gathering speed and in what ways the past 50,000 years, and the fact that natural selection may be changing the human genome faster than ever. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Or if you'd like to send us an email, as somebody already has, that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor John Hawks, assistant professor of anthropology at UW-Madison, is our guest. And let's go to an email first, and then we'll take a few phone calls here. This one is Larry from Madison. Professor Hawks, how will scientific advances affect the human species? For example, babies born with spina bifida or premature babies. As cruel as it sounds, nature has a way of weeding out the weak. Now it doesn't, or does it? Your guest comments on malaria are interesting. How has our lifestyle affected our closest cousins, the primates, or has it?
Okay, well, let me, I guess, start with the first part of that. You know, when we think about medical technology and how people are surviving now who might have died, you know, that's without question, a hugely positive thing. You know, death is bad, and we like to prevent it. But on the other hand, a lot of people are concerned that, hey, look, if people are surviving now who would have died before, doesn't that mean that our genetic nature will become weaker in the future? To understand a little bit about why I don't worry about this so much, I think that you have to really understand the force of natural selection. Natural selection works because people vary in the time that they die and in the time and numbers in which they reproduce. So basically death and reproduction. That's the bottom line of evolution. Evolution doesn't care how smart you are, doesn't care, you know, whether people like you. All it cares about is whether you survive.
Mm-hmm.
So on the first level, you say, well, people are surviving now who might have died before. That's got to change the bottom line, right? And it's true. When we look at mortality today, mortality, the time of death in Western societies, and I have to be very specific because in a lot of the world, this is not true. And deaths in childhood, infant deaths, and young adulthood still are happening at high rates. When we talk about Western society and medical technology and how people are surviving longer, it means that the variation in mortality has gone down. Now, variation in mortality going down means that natural selection has become vastly weaker. But that doesn't mean that we're suddenly going to change to all of us be genetically weaker, or that the genes involved in certain kinds of maybe maladaptive in a natural context phenotypes, like diseases, those aren't going to magically become more common just because we've stopped people dying from them. For them to magically become more common, the people who survive with these would have to have more offspring than everyone else.
Hmm.
And that, as far as we can tell, isn't likely to happen. So it's a good thing that people are surviving who would have died. And in the future, I expect that on mortality grounds, there's going to be very little additional change. Now, fertility is something different. You know, people reproduce at different times today. They reproduce in different numbers, and there's no stopping that. You know, medical technology is not making everyone have identical numbers of kids. So on that basis, if there were changes that were related to how many kids people are having or when they choose to have them, those changes would potentially be selected in the future. It's hard for me as an anthropologist to say what those changes might be. You know, it's hard to predict.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for your interesting comments. Let's go to Barbara from Madison. Hi, Barbara.
Oh, good morning. I'm just enjoying this conversation this morning so very much. And, well, I'm really an old person. I've been around. I'm in my 80s. And I just observed that there just seems to be a lot more occurrences of asthma, autism, and diabetes. among our young people. And you know, this is troubling to me, and I'm wondering if in your research if you've discovered why this is occurring.
Well, I can talk about diabetes a little bit, because my brother's diabetic, and he's type 1, but the real increase that we're seeing is type 2 diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
And this traditionally has affected older people, but it's starting to affect younger people in greater numbers. Of course, the reason for that is we're getting fatter as a society. This is all sort of stemming from obesity and also from diet. We've changed our diet to some extent from the diet even of early agriculturalists. You think of people who started to grow grains in large amounts, and they were eating grains, they were eating less of other kinds of vegetables, and they were eating less meat. That shift was a major change to the digestive system in human evolution. The societies that underwent that shift earliest, and here we're talking about West Asia, like Mesopotamia, we're talking about Europe, we're talking about North Africa and East Asia, where they have rice agriculture very early. Those agriculturalists started to have new genes that were adapted to this diet of grains and especially starches. So for one, you have a digestive enzyme in your mouth. It's called amylase, and it's in your saliva. Amylase digests starch. It breaks starch down into sugars. And people who've lived in these agricultural populations for a long time have multiple copies of this gene. The gene is duplicated. So people who've lived in agricultural populations make more amylase. People who live in these agricultural populations have other genes that have helped to adapt their digestive system and their metabolism to this high starch, which means high sugar diet.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see, and I'm studying these now, one or two genes that are protective from type 2 diabetes in Europeans, a different couple of genes in Asians. These genes have arisen because of the metabolic changes that have come from these diet shifts. Now, today, over the course of the past 100 years, what you're seeing is an increase in refined starch. So, you know, the big fluffy buns on the fast food hamburger. Nobody who was an early agriculturalist ate anything like this, right? Mm. This is refined starch. Those refined starches are broken down very rapidly into simple sugars. We're seeing an increase in sugar and high fructose corn syrup consumption. So soft drinks, all kinds of juices that aren't 100% juice, all of those things, we're bringing in sugar. And our systems are not well adapted to this.
Hmm.
You know, to begin with, our systems are adapted to a diet where we eat small amounts of lean meats and fresh, raw vegetables. Then they're partially adapted to a diet of lots of whole grains and starches, partially adapted in some populations more than others. When we see populations today that have very high diabetes incidence, you know, people like the people of Polynesia or like the Native Americans of the Southwest, these are folks who haven't been agriculturalists for a long time, and they haven't had the opportunity to have new adaptive changes to this diet. And so today, they're not ready for it to the same extent that somebody who's lived in Europe for a long time or West Asia for a long time might be.
Interesting.
But none of us are ready for the fast food, high soda intake, lots of corn syrup diet. And none of us are ready for this. And so some of us react better than others to it. You know, we're variable in this, but our variation is not able to keep up with the real shift in this diet.
Anything else, Barbara?
Oh, I appreciate your comments so much. Thank you.
You sound so youthful, Barbara.
Thank you.
Don't you?
I feel youthful.
Yeah, you sure exuded over the
public
phone here.
Radio keeps me that way.
All right. Thanks, Barbara. Let's go to Wendy from Peoria, Illinois. Hi, Wendy.
Hi. I have a question about a book that I haven't read, but I believe it's called The Seven Daughters of Eve. And the premise is that we are all descended from seven basic genomes. And I wondered what the guest had to say about that. Is that true, or is the book's premise incorrect.
Well, I know this book, and people have, I think it's bringing out what people have become very interested in about human genetics today, which is the opportunity to trace your ancestors. You know, so if you knew what your genotype was for this gene, and the one we're talking about is the mitochondrial DNA, this gene is inherited only from the mother. And so if you think about your own mitochondrial DNA, if you look at your mother, that's where you got it from, your maternal grandmother, your maternal great-grandmother, and so on. It goes back to one ancestor always on the female line. Now, if you think about it, think about how many ancestors you have total, not just on one line, but total. You know, your parents, you have two of them. Your grandparents, you have four of them. Your great-grandparents, you have eight, and then 16, and 32, and so on. Well, after 10 generations, so just 10 generations in the past, you have 1,000 potential ancestors.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, because it's increasing, it's doubling every generation. If we go back 20 generations in the past, 20 generations here, we're talking about 500 years ago, you have 1,000,000.
Woo!
If you go back 30 generations, you have 1,000,000,000.
Wow.
Remember, every generation, it's doubling.
Yeah.
Now, before very long, if you go back 40 generations, now we're talking about 1,000 years ago, 40 generations ago, you have 1,000,000,000,000.
Now, oh, my gosh.
There weren't 1,000,000,000,000 people in the world then. it just didn't happen. Now, you say, well, how can this be? I have two ancestors for every one of those in every generation. It's got to double every time. Well, except that some of those are the same people. This is what we call inbreeding. Now, when we think of inbreeding, you tend to think of, you know, something, there's this X-Files where the people have been living in one house since the Civil War and mating with their mother and that sort of thing. Yeah, that's inbreeding. But actually, everybody on Earth is inbred to some degree. Your parents are related to each other. Your grandparents were related to each other. Now, if you live in a small town, there's a good chance that you know what this relationship is. You know, maybe they're third cousins of each other or something. If you live in a big city or you've come from somewhere else, the odds are that you don't know. But the fact is that your parents are cousins of each other in some way. That means that over long stretches of time, over tens or hundreds of generations, the genes are limited. They're only coming from a small group of people. And some of those people are proliferating their genes more than others. So if you know about genealogy, the odds are, and you're living in the U.S. and you have any ancestry at all in England, if you know about genealogy before about 300 or 400 years ago, the chances are it's because you're related to some king. And the reason for this is twofold. One, the kings kept track. So these genealogies are well known. But the other is that the kings tended to have kids, and they had lots of them. And not always legitimate kids. So genes are coming from relatively small groups of people over long stretches of time.
That is absolutely fascinating. Wendy?
For the seven daughters subject, if you go back a few thousand years, those maternal lines all trace back to a relatively small number, a few women.
Guess it's time to read the book, huh, Wendy?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for the call. And what about, you know, general advice here that the more distant the cousin you marry, the better or not?
It seems to be paradoxical. For instance, there's a study in Iceland not too long ago, this spring, that looked at people who were married to distant cousins, like third or fourth cousins, versus people who were unrelated completely as far as anybody knew, and people who were really close. And they found that being married to your third or fourth cousin was the best. but when we say best, what we mean is how many kids you have. This is all about evolution. Now, Darwin was married to his cousin. And he was very happily married, and they had lots of kids. You know, there's nothing wrong with being married to your cousin, except that if you happen to carry a recessive lethal gene or recessive deleterious gene, that's something that you could carry without knowing it. And you're more likely to share those with your cousins. So people point to cousin marriage and say, well, there's a small increase in the chance that you have kids that have one of these recessive genetic diseases. And that's certainly true. But by and large, over the, you know, when we look at human societies around the world, there are some where cousin marriage is preferred. It's a way to keep things in the family. There are some where cousin marriage is shunned, like ours.
Right. Thank you so much for the call, Wendy. Let's go to Bob from Sullivan. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I'm kind of curious if I could get a response to this. For a long time, I've thought about it. You know, we loose a lot of chemicals out into the environment. You know, there's new chemicals released every year. They're dumped all over our agricultural fields. We lather them all over our bodies with soaps and lotions, and they're in detergents, and the air and the water. How are you seeing this affecting us evolutionarily? Some of these chemicals have to be binding with the eggs and the sperm that are creating the babies. How are all these chemicals going to affect us evolutionarily?
When we look at chemicals that are mutagens of different types, you know, they cause mutations. You know, those, for instance, survivors of the atomic bombs in Japan, people, they were studied for a long time. The primary effect of these, of course, is on your body and not on your reproductive system. So, you know, the main thing that we see is an increase in cancers. Secondarily, study the children of survivors, they have a slightly higher chance of having genetic changes. Now, so that major chemical radiation effect, it has a slight effect on what we can see genetically. Now, in evolutionary terms, any change that happens is going to survive or become extinct on the basis of what it does to the body, to the phenotype. Most genetic changes do nothing at all. Of those who do something, most of them do something slightly bad, and those tend to get weeded out over time. A few of them do something that's potentially good, and those will have the chance of increasing in frequency. When we look at chemicals that are released in the environment, you know, there are lots of different ones today, and individually, they all might have some very small effect on people. Individually, we'd say any chemical, in evolutionary terms, not likely to have a large effect. And evolution corrects itself. You know, if it has an effect by causing a bad mutation, then that mutation isn't going to survive. Very unfortunate for the person who's affected, but in terms of what happens to the human population as a whole, very minimal effect. Collectively, you might wonder, well, you know, there's lots and lots of different things. Is there anything that, you know, people could pick up on that might have some radically different effect in combination? I don't know. Studying combinations of things is hard science. Difficult. It's hard to work out these chemical combinations. Let's take the primary chemicals that we put in the environment, and that's drugs that we administer to people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's directly putting chemicals into people's bodies to have good effects on them. You know, people take these drugs for years and years and years, and they have positive effects, but we still can't predict the combinations of all the different possible drug interactions that could happen because, A, when you start giving people not one drug for many years, but six or seven drugs for many years, everybody has a different combination of six or seven. That's many, many times the number of interactions that any study tracks. And the other thing is that every person has the potential of reacting differently to every drug. So when I think of the way that we're, in technological and chemical terms, altering the environment, look at drug interactions as one way of seeing how complicated it is to figure out.
And we had a listener on an email who wanted to have you comment on any potential short or long-term effects from the entrance of genetically modified foods into the human diet, Professor Hawks?
Well, as far as we can tell, in genetic terms, you know, we're eating chemically or we're eating genetically modified foods in lots of different ways now, and there's nothing in these genetically modified organisms that is, in genetic terms, different than any other food that we eat. So your body can digest DNA. We can deal with it. And so just genetically modifying an organism is not going to have an effect on the nutribility of the food or your ability to digest it. It's not going to affect your system in terms of, you know, having it doesn't spread any kind of contamination to you because it's genetically modified. If you think about it, all of our food is genetically modified. 10,000 years ago, corn, which is all around us now here in Wisconsin, corn was a weed that lived in marshy environments in Mexico. It didn't have ears. It had little seeds that grew in one spike that shattered off, and they're hard seeds. I mean, if you ever seen Teosinte seeds, they're like, you know, you could never eat them because they're little hard little things. That change from this wild organism to today's hybrid corn, that has been massive, much greater in genetic terms. It's involved gene duplications. It's involved selection on large fractions of the corn genome. It's involved huge changes to the plant in its form. It's involved keeping inbred strains and blending those so that we can have the seeds that grow with hybrid vigor. All of those things are so huge. You know, if anything genetically from this modification was going to affect us, it would have affected us long ago.
Hmm. Bob, anything else?
I guess I'm just concerned because we didn't evolve with these chemicals in our environment. And there are so many of them, and they're so pervasive. That, you know, we're discovering endocrine interrupters. I guess I'm just not placated. I think it's a bigger problem than is being mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Professor Hawks?
Well, when we look at effects on the human population as a whole, you know, the population as a whole will sort of sink or swim on the basis of what's happening to the huge majority of people. And when we release chemicals in the environment, of course, this is going to affect some people. But the fraction of people that have a, you know, there's a fraction of people who are going to have some severe effect from any dangerous chemical, right? But that fraction of people is not going to affect the human race as a whole. So, you know, from that standpoint, I would say, you know, my concern as an anthropologist is not studying, you know, what happens to a few people, but is studying, you know, sort of the trends, mm-hmm. what's going to happen to the whole population.
Professor John Hawks, our guest this hour, assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His research areas include paleoanthropology, anthropological genomics, and population genetics, statistical approaches to fragmentary samples, and old world. We're going in lots of directions, but he caught our attention with an interview that is online. We'll give you an address in a moment. And it concerns human evolution, which he says has been gathering speed for the past 50,000 years, and natural selection may be changing the human genome faster than ever. One line is open. Two lines are open, actually, if you'd like to join the conversation. It's 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Milwaukee is 414-227-2050, or that email is open to you as well, which is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to your phone calls for Professor John Hawks, and we go next to Jeanette from Milwaukee. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, thank you. About 3 or 4 years ago, my brother and I we swabbed our cheeks for a DNA sample and sent it into this National Geographic Genome Project. I don't know if you've heard about it, but it was related to the documentary on public television called Journey of Man.
I know it well, yep.
Okay. I was just wondering if are there any further developments from all the testing they have done? And my second question is, concerning racial characteristics, if you're Nordic, for example, or black, and you switch environments, would your racial characteristics like blonde hair, blue eyes, black hair, dark skin evolve and change in time?
Well, let's take the second part of that first, because that's something that's happened a lot over the course of human history. You know, people move. And when they move to new places, the genes that are well adapted to the old place that they used to live aren't necessarily the best adapted anymore. You know, so what's the effect of this? Well, if you move to a new place, you are not going to change. You know, that's your genes are your genes. They're your genes forever. If you have a population of folks that starts to send migrants to a new place, the maybe best understood example of this, or a really easy to illustrate example of this, is people who moved into the New World 10,000 years ago, the original Native Americans. These folks come from Northeast Asia. They spread into Alaska and from there into the entirety of the New World. And they're well adapted to Northeast Asia. It takes them a long time to reach South America. But when we say long time in terms of movement, you know, we're talking about tens of thousands of miles, but it takes maybe a few hundred years to get there. So this spread in human terms takes a long time, but in geologic terms, evolutionary terms, it happens almost instantaneously. When people get to the tropical part of the New World, they start to experience selection to darken their skin tone. And you see that the Native Americans who live in equatorial areas, Brazil, Peru, Ecuador, darker skin tone than people who lived in North America, northern part of the United States. That gradation developed over the course of a few thousand years, and that's adaptation. That's a population moves to a new place. It experiences selective pressure that comes from its environment, in this case, the environment of solar radiation, and it starts to change. If you have a set of people who move to a new place because they're migrating and they start intermarrying with the people there, well, then the genes that survive or don't survive depend on their local advantages. You know, so if we follow folks for a few hundred generations, some of their genes might do very well. So, for instance, Rome had an African slave trade. They had a slave trade all over the Mediterranean, but some of those folks came from Africa. Italy, starting in about 400 BC, got malaria. Malaria came in from Africa. Coastal areas, low-lying places in Italy, they were malarial areas until really the early 1900s. African genes that helped to resist malaria spread from those slaves into the Italian population because of their advantage in malaria fighting. Other genes did not spread or proliferate in the same way. So over long scopes of time, genes survive or don't survive based on what the genes do.
Jeanette?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Do you hear at all? Are they keeping you? They're not keeping you informed of the National Geographic?
No, we did get the results of what
you were
in. My brother's is slightly different than mine, and a map indicating where we started from in Africa.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and the route that the male marker on the male side took, and they told me, because mine took longer, that it's harder to trace the female chromosomes results. But I got mine, too, in a map, and that's how I'm studying genealogy.
Oh, my, interesting.
It's a very fascinating thing for people to participate in now. I would say that project has been ongoing, and they're still collecting samples. You know, they're still trying to get DNA from a number of indigenous populations around the world. Their goal is to trace these migrations. I don't keep real close track of it because my goals are different. I try to trace other kinds of genes that are functional, that do things. And these genes were specifically chosen because they think they didn't do very much. But I'll say, you know, it's a very interesting thing to be able to look back through these relationships now and say, you know, we have groups of folks who are in Europe now who 10,000 years ago, their maternal ancestors were somewhere completely different, you know, maybe West Asia. And they came in after that time. And we can determine that with the genetic relationships.
Where is all of this science and your work going to proceed in the next 10 years? If we've learned so much here just in the past few years, where are we going, Professor Hawks?
Well, I would say in terms of studying the functions of genes, it seems fairly clear that over the course of the next 5 to 10 years, more and more people are going to have their DNA tested in medical terms, because they're going to find out that there are genes that make you more susceptible to, say, heart disease, diabetes, Alzheimer's. We've already found some of those genes. And people want to be able to sort of predict, you know, is there something I could do now to change my diet or to change my exercise regimen that would have an effect on me? What will be key in the next 10 years is studying interactions. You know, you've got 20,000 genes, and maybe 100 of them affect your chance of having heart disease. And some of those genes work through the pathway of salt metabolism. So, for instance, there are folks in sub-Saharan Africa today and people of African American descent who have genes that are high salt retention. That retention is about living in a hot tropical place and having, you know, you're sweating a lot in that place and you want to retain your salt. You know, it's good for you to do that. But that creates the potential of a hypertension problem, you know, high blood pressure. That pathway depends on your ancestry. Other genes have different pathways. You know, whether you build up plaques or not in your coronary arteries, this probably has a totally different pathway that is different in people of a different ancestry. And so what we're going to be able to learn is the way that these genes contribute to disease risk, because some people might be well suited to be on a blood pressure reducing medicine for a long time, and other people might have very little effect on them, and they might be better off on a statin, like Lipitor or something, you know, for a long time, if your goal is to reduce heart disease. So what we're going to discover is that our ancestry has a lot to do with our health. And for me, that's exciting because it makes the anthropology relevant.
Right.
You know, I'm studying these ancient environments and why we have these genes. And today, they're still affecting people.
Sure. Carl from Madison writes, why does nearsightedness persist? Why hasn't it been bred out?
Well, nearsightedness, it appears, has been increasing in frequency over time. And that's partly because of environment. You know, when you're using your eyes on close things a lot and not using them at a long distance as much, that affects your propensity to be nearsighted. But also genetically, there's a very clear mutation that's related to myopia, nearsightedness, and that mutation is relatively new. It's been increasing in frequency over time. Now, we look at this and say, why is this mutation increasing? We can see it's selected. It's doing something. And when we say something's selected, that means that it's making people survive more and have more kids. But I couldn't tell you why it's selected. Presumably, it's not because being nearsighted makes you have more kids. Although anything's possible, right? You know, maybe if you're nearsighted, you're less likely to look across the room at the woman, you know, the other woman. You know, and we can make up any kind of stories about it.
Yeah.
But the evolutionary scenario is one in which this gene almost certainly has some other effect, and the disadvantage that it carries, being nearsighted, has reduced in its severity as people have become sedentary, as they've become less dependent on hunting and gathering. You know, that gene no longer has the bad effect that it used to have, you know, because nearsightedness is not killing people anymore. But whatever good effect it might have has remained. So when we see genetic changes, often they carry bad along with the good, or at least things that we don't like. One of these genes that has a potential, you know, a negative effect or a negative connotation to its effect is a gene called DRD4. This gene is the D4 dopamine receptor, and dopamine is a chemical, it's a neurotransmitter in the brain. It affects your behavior. The D4 dopamine receptor has a mutation called the 7R mutation, because it's got 7 repeats in it. That mutation, people who carry it, more likely to be ADHD diagnosed. So this is something that explains maybe 20 or 30% of ADHD diagnoses in the U.S. And as you know, that's another one of these conditions where the diagnosis has been really increasing over the past few years. That's something that we look at and we say, this is bad, right? We don't want our kids to have ADD. You know, this is something that we try to stamp out of the classroom. And we view these kids as problem children when they're diagnosed this way. And we try to treat them with pharmaceuticals. But this mutation has been increasing in frequency for the past 30,000 years. It's getting more common because it lets people survive and have more kids.
Hmm.
Now, I don't know why it does. We don't know what the good effect of this gene is. Potentially, and some people are investigating this, potentially it has to do with longevity. Potentially it has to do with exercise, activity.
Hmm.
Whatever it is, we know that this gene, in evolutionary terms, has been unambiguously good.
Yeah, we have to stop, unfortunately. We could talk all forever. Website, johnhawks.net, to get more information about all this?
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Wonderful. Thank you. Wait, isn't it great to be able to answer all these questions? This is what a life you have. It's wonderful. Thanks. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Professor John Hawks, Assistant Professor of Anthropology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. What an interesting hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, John Treader for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios, and thanks, everybody, for your interest and your calls and your emails and everything. News is coming up from National Public Radio. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 with Jeremy Scahill. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.